is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today, because of our mechanical difficulties that we're still dealing with, I'm going to play another rebroadcast for you, but one of my favorites. It has to do with the question of what does it mean to be human? There are many theories of the evolution of human behavior which seek to explain how our brains evolved to support our unique abilities and personalities. Most of these theories have related to the size of the human brain or specific genetic adaptations. In contrast, Fred Previc is a man who has presented a provocative theory about dopamine, widely studied neurotransmitter. It accounts for all major aspects of modern human behavior. He further believes that the great achievements of the dopaminergic mind and the harmful effects of raising dopamine result in a critical problem that we are dealing with. So, my friends, this is Armand DeMille with you. I want to bring you one of my favorite of all of the interviews that I've done, Dr. Fred Previc, here on WBAI. Welcome to the station.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, great. Fred, so tell me, Fred, tell me about existence. Give me the history of man.
Well, you know, one of the ultimate questions in certainly the biological and social sciences, but in science in general, is what makes us human? How did we become human? And there have been a lot of different theories, some related to increases in brain size. Some theories have proposed specific genes for language or this or that trait. But I think it ultimately relates to the fact that human brains, relative to other apes and hominids, and certainly relative to other mammals, most other mammals, have an enormous amount of dopamine. And dopamine is a transmitter that's been widely studied. It's been involved in a lot of different processes. It's been facetiously termed every man's transmitter because it seems to have been linked to so many different types of functions, every function almost.
Okay, Fred, so if you allow me, let's go back. You know, when you say transmitter from scientist to scientist, everybody understands you're talking about a neurotransmitter. Most of the people listening think you're getting out a radio as a transmitter. And that was a wonderful thing about the early hominids is they had a radio. No, we have neurotransmitters. Now, the early thing was something about the human brain, which had to figure out a way to exist. And the human brain, in its evolution, developed a kind of a series of neurotransmitters and hormones that kind of fed the entire system like all other animals have. So could you talk about the general overview of the neurotransmitters first, and then we'll get down to dopamine?
Well, humans, as with all other primates and most mammals, have a lot of different transmitters and varying concentrations. Some, like humans, have a lot more dopamine than other creatures. A transmitter is simply a chemical messenger in the brain. It crosses what we call a synapse and locks in with a receptor on the next nerve cell in line and then allows the transmission of messages to occur.
Now, what are the different names, some of the different transmitters?
Well, some of the transmitters are, widely studied transmitters are dopamine, norepinephrine, also known as noradrenaline, also glutamate, GABA, aminobutyric acid, GABA, and serotonin and acetylcholine. Those seem to be the major ones that have been studied in mammals and primates.
And each neurotransmitter seems to do a different thing, right? Each neurotransmitter, dopamine is different than serotonin. It's not like if you want to get a nerve transmission, you could use either one or the other. It's like you need to use one for one specific purpose and another for another specific purpose. Is that true?
That is true, and some transmitters are more specific than others in their function.
Which are more general? Like, is acetylcholine more more general than dopamine, for example?
Well, I would say glutamate is a general excitatory transmitter. GABA is a generally is an inhibitory transmitter in the brain. But dopamine is very specific to a number of functions, as is serotonin and noradrenaline. Acetylcholine also is somewhat specialized. Dopamine and acetylcholine are prominent in motor function, perhaps to a little greater extent than some of the other transmitters. And also, they do differ in their distributions in the brain. For instance, in the left hemisphere, dopamine and acetylcholine seem to be the predominant neurotransmitters.
And the left hemisphere regulates what part of human functioning usually?
Well, the left hemisphere is generally considered the more typical of our advanced human abilities. For instance, mathematical abilities, language, logical thinking, analytical reasoning, these sorts of things are in the left hemisphere. The right hemisphere seems to be more involved in social and emotional skills, and maybe also in certain visual spatial relations.
So we would say more of the physical on the right side and the intellectual on the left side?
Well, I like to use the word earthy. I think the right hemisphere is a little earthier. It's more in tune with its body, but the left hemisphere is a little bit, more involved in thinking, I think, about more distant things and more abstract things.
So humans, in their evolution, had to develop, developed more of the left hemisphere, is what you're saying. That the left hemispheric development helped the human emerge out of its simian ancestry.
Well, certainly there has been an increase in the degree of lateralization of the human brain relative to other primates. There is some evidence that there is some lateralization in other primate species, and indeed, occasionally you'll find it throughout the mammalian groups. But generally, lateralization is greater in humans, but also beyond the lateralization, there's also been an increase in dopamine, which happens to be predominant in the left hemisphere, but probably even the right hemisphere of humans has more dopamine than say, many other creatures.
Well, you know, we keep coming back to that word, dopamine. We're speaking with Fred H. Previck, author of a book that was tossed into our direction, The Dopaminergic Mind in Human Evolution and History. Fred has written a number of articles that I've read, not only on this subject, but even on religion and understanding of things in general. And I love the way he thinks we have to follow it. Fred, when using a word lateralization, that means, by definition, two hemispheres?
It does.
Okay. We just got to, because we have to remember, as we use words that are common to us, a radio audience who is going to be listening to this, some of them haven't spent that much time knowing this. Let's go to dopamine, the importance of dopamine. Your study and your presentation, The Dopaminergic Mind. I want people to learn to pronounce that. Not dopaminergic, but dopaminergic, right? Dopamine is a thing, dopaminergic. What is a dopaminergic brain?
A dopaminergic brain is a brain that is very much concerned with goal-directedness, achievement orientation, distant space, and a lot of the intellectual and psychological processes that are related to those. It is not concerned about so much eating an apple that's already in our hand. That's something that what other systems might be involved in. It's not as much involved in emotional reactions, but it seems to be mediating our drive towards distant space and even in humans, abstract space. So if we think in terms of abstract concepts such as heaven or eternity, these are very abstract concepts. If you don't have a dopaminergic mind, you're not going to be thinking in terms of these concepts. And you're not going to be able to do a lot of abstract intellectual manipulations, such as mathematics or complex grammar interpretation.
then to take it a step before that, the dopaminergic mind is also the future planning mind. So it's the kind of mind that would say, you see those baboons over there? They've got that fig tree. Let's go over there and take over that fig tree. That kind of extensive thinking, that thinking that goes beyond, is what you're saying is part of the dopaminergic mind, part of the kind of drive to achieve and to future predict and to kind of take over. I mean, isn't the dopaminergic mind at its worst extent a warlike creature?
Well, when you let's go back to what you're saying about strategizing, planning. Yes, because it's concerned with distant spatial and temporal events, the dopaminergic mind is great at strategizing and planning. It does not exist in the immediate moment as much as a non-dopaminergic mind. But you mentioned, did you say warlike?
Yes, I mentioned warlike.
Well, there is some links to aggression that dopamine may, perhaps be involved in, but I don't think that's the main function of the dopaminergic mind. It is related perhaps to some aspects of characteristic male behaviors, masculine behaviors, such as male sexual activity in animals. And to the extent that it's involved in aggression, maybe that's part of the an extension of the masculine style. But it is not, the major purpose of dopamine in the brain.
So dopamine has somehow helped us evolve as a human race. Now, the opposite of dopamine would be serotonergic, I guess. Is that true?
Yes, serotonin seems to be involved in many of the opposite processes. I can't say they're 100% opposite. But, for instance, when we're orienting towards distant space, when we're looking for things, searching for things in distant space, dopamine and dopamine transmission in the brain would be very active. Serotonin, conversely, would be actually less active. And even in some mundane behaviors like rearing and climbing behavior in animals, serotonin would have the opposite effect because climbing behavior is a part of a whole host of what we call upwardly biased behaviors that relate to distant space, because if we look out at the world, most of the distant world is in the upper part of our visual field, in upper space.
And so therefore that's most of the way humans have evolved. To get where they are, to be the masters, you should pardon the expression, of the universe, to be the top dog right now, the humans are at the top. The way we've done it is through the dopaminergic mind. We certainly didn't do it through the serotonergic mind, because that would be a much more passive way of being, right?
Yes, we definitely know that structures that are very rich in dopamine, extremely rich in dopamine in the brain, have been the ones that have expanded most during human evolution. So there's no question that dopamine is one of the major transmitters that has expanded during human evolution. The evidence for other transmitters being altered is less impressive.
Right. You say that dopamine has a major contribution to the intelligence and the six primary cognitive skills. Can we talk about those skills?
Yes. I basically, in a 1999 article, talked about the cognitive skills that would be associated with dopamine, also in the left hemisphere. One involves motor planning, and people don't realize it, but when we're thinking, we're actually activating motor circuits, and language has the same rhythm as chewing does. So these are all motor activities, and they involve a lot of motor planning when we speak and things like that. Also, another skill is working memory, the ability to hold things in memory while we're doing other things, and that's very important. As we're carrying out an activity, we keep the goal in mind. We keep things in mind at the same time we're doing other activities.
Can we slow that one down just
sure.
a second to appreciate that? Because working memory, which is not very often spoken about, is what Fred is saying. He's saying, you know, the real important aspect of human functioning, the ability to keep your goal in mind when you're doing certain activities, because if your memory did not hold your goal in mind, you'd just be moving on from thing to thing, as many people we know do. So that's called working memory. What is cognitive flexibility?
Well, cognitive flexibility basically is when the environment, the conditions in the environment change. For instance, you have a plan, it doesn't work, you have to shift strategies. You might call it shifting strategies. That's probably the best way to describe it. And this is something that definitely requires dopamine. And in fact, working memory and cognitive flexibility or shifting strategies are the two things we term together executive intelligence, because you can imagine executives in companies really need to know when to shift strategies. They have to keep the goal in mind while they're performing activities. So this is something that requires dopamine, and people who have a lot of dopamine generally are good, what we call strategic thinkers.
You know, I don't want to get off. Well, I want to finish the six first. Abstract representation and temporal analysis sequencing, also two other characteristics, right?
Yes. Abstract representation simply refers to our ability to understand concepts or relate concepts to the world around us. And it's, you know, it's surprisingly, but it's actually an extension of perhaps the most distant portion of our space. We can think of exploring, you know, say the most distant portion of physical space, but then we can explore even beyond our immediate physical space into abstract the future or talk about the past. And these are things that involve what we call offline thinking, and those are abstract concepts. As far as temporal processing, dopamine is known to increase the processing speed of our minds, and that's very important in something like language. Language, the words are coming at us, the phonemes, very, very rapidly, and the acoustic transients that we use to know whether something's a one consonant or another, they're operating in a matter of milliseconds, so we need a very fast processing capability, and that's something that dopamine provides us.
So you're how are we doing, by the way, so far, Fred? You like this? Because just think about this. Where we've gone, and thanks to dopamine, I'm sure, you're now able to take your thoughts, your private thoughts, are going to some other side of the globe, because there are people in China who download this program, and they're going to listen to it, and they're going to say, what is that man saying? And they're going to say, what an interesting thought. Just to think how far we've gone. Couldn't have gone that way without dopamine, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, your voice in China right now could not exist without your own dopaminergic development.
You're absolutely correct. All humans are, and especially modern-day humans, are very dopaminergic. And, of course, some people, you know, even in today's society, have probably more dopamine than others.
Okay. Now, what about hyperdopaminergic? What does that mean?
Well, this is a perhaps a somewhat controversial concept, but I believe that the levels of dopamine in our brains just didn't evolve and then stop evolving. I believe that our transmitters are changing their concentrations and their activity levels even as our modern-day societies are evolving. And I think the demands of modern society have placed an emphasis on dopamine. And I believe that people in today's societies, with the demands on competitiveness and achievement orientation and all, are actually increasing the levels of dopamine in our brain. And I think that one consequence, possibly, is that we are seeing an increase in a number of disorders that are linked to excessive dopamine.
Well, good. Let's go into those. And Stephanie, join us for this conversation, because I know this is of a particular interest to you. You know Stephanie Dombra. Stephanie, hi.
Hi, Armand. Hi,
Stephanie.
Fred.
Hi.
Yes, let's talk about this relationship of dopamine to the different mental health disorders.
Well, dopamine has been involved, implicated in a number of disorders that are very much talked about in today's world. Autism, attention deficit with hyperactivity disorder, schizophrenia, which is a, you know, long-standing disorder, doesn't seem to be really increasing, but it's still very well studied because it's such a fascinating disorder.
Well, wait. How does hyperdopaminergic functioning lead to schizophrenia?
Well, one of the long-standing theories, and I think it's widely accepted, this is not controversial, that schizophrenics have excessive dopamine, and it's like their left hemisphere is especially active, which has, you know, the predominant amount of dopamine in the brain. And a lot of the symptoms of schizophrenia, such as some of the delusions, some of the hallucinations and things like that, can be traced to excessive dopamine.
Sure, it would make sense because it's all the imaging, it's all the imagining, it's all the future thinking, a lot of that, and a lot of that, which is what usually gets people to have mental disorders, which is their thinking. You know, it's their minds going out on an edge, and dopamine helps your mind go out to the edge. It makes you reach for things. So I can see that. What about manic depressive disorder or bipolar disorder?
Bipolar disorder, of course, you fluctuate between, and in different time frames, some people fluctuate more frequently than others, between a manic phase and a depressed phase. In the manic phase, dopamine seems to be very much activated, and a lot of the compulsions, the obsessions, the high activity levels, because remember, dopamine is very much involved in the motor system, and excessive dopamine does lead to hyperactivity. So a lot of the manic phase seems to be accompanied by a rise in dopamine levels.
How do you measure that? Can you measure it through neuroscience? Can you do it through brain imaging?
Well, nowadays you can do it through brain imaging. You can record the amount of dopamine receptor activity during different phases. But one of the things that we know about all of the hyperdopaminergic disorders, they are helped when you lower dopamine levels if you block the transmission of dopamine in the brain.
And blocking the transmission of dopamine is done through medication, through chemicals?
Yes, through chemicals, medication, a lot of widely used clinical drugs. Usually they occupy the receptor sites on the next nerve cell down the line, and so it blocks the ability for that nerve cell to be activated.
So what we're doing is not only suppressing but stopping the birth of it. We're stopping the emergence of the dopamine through the medications, and that's how they treat people.
Yes, you're diminishing the amount of transmission that dopamine has in the brain.
All right. Other things like ADHD and Tourette's syndrome, how are those affected by dopamine?
Well, again, Tourette's syndrome seems to be more of a motor disorder, although there's certainly psychological, you know, correlates. Now, attention deficit disorder is very interesting because there's evidence that that dopamine is both increased and decreased. But I think the best model that I accept is that in one particular part of the brain, what I call the medial dopamine systems, that dopamine is elevated, and that by increasing dopamine in the second portion of the brain, you're actually inhibiting that other section, and that helps relieve some of the attention deficit disorder problems.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Fred Previck. We're talking about the dopaminergic mind. It's a complex concept, my friends. It's really not that complex. We're talking about a neurotransmitter called dopamine and how it has played a role in the evolution of humankind and how, in a way, as it continues to develop, as it continues to grow, as we continue to use it, utilize it, and expand our dopaminergic production, that we are kind of probably heading ourselves towards our own annihilation. Because there seems to be that it just gets to a point where you're just pushing and pushing and pushing, and you don't even know why you're pushing anymore. If you increase, Fred, if you increase somebody's dopamine, if you give them an injection of dopamine, if they eat some dopamine food, right, and will they just find themselves running around doing everything? Is it like a hyperactivity that follows with excessive dopamine?
Well, if you gave them enough dopamine, yes, you would get some hyperactivity. Actually, I have a colleague, Dr. Peter Brueger in Zurich, Switzerland, who actually gave some a dopamine precursor to some of his subjects, and he doesn't want to do those studies anymore because he started getting behavior that resembled not schizophrenia. We call it more schizotypy, which is a normal variant. But he just said, you know, I just don't really want to do that anymore. That's just not something people would do in studies. Even low levels can change the way we view the world. And to make a long story short, there isn't a lot of evidence as far as what would happen. But we do know what happens when we stop the medication for some of these disorders. Things definitely get worse.
Well, also, Fred, I believe that all these issues that we're dealing with in our present day, all addictions, the substances, food, sex, all these things are elevating our dopamine, and we're on these kind of roller coaster rides. And I often want people to understand that there's a lot of chemistry, that there should be no kind of criticism of themselves, that they're on those kind of vicious cycles. And I try to explain to them that there's a lot of things going on inside their brain that's causing them to behave a certain way or to have this compulsion. And it kind of at least lessens all that guilt and shame. So that could be like a first step. But I believe that all over the place, everyone's activating this dopamine artificially.
Yes, I mean, there's certainly our society rewards people who have a lot of dopamine because those are generally the high achievers and are thinking, you know, very creatively with very abstract concepts, distant focus, future-oriented, things like that. But the problem is that as everybody's dopamine levels are rising in our society, some people who, for whatever reason, their genes or, you know, whatever, might already be prone to have a lot of dopamine, that just might push them to, you know, what we might call unhealthy levels. So it's something that I believe, as you say, is something that our society is going to have to deal with as a society. It's not just enough to say this individual has too much dopamine or, you know, whatever.
Very interesting. Very interesting, Fred. We're going to have to take a short break, and when we take a short break, you could stay with us. I know you're on a class schedule. You're running between classes, but if you could stay with us, we have to do a station break, we have to do station identification, and when we come back, we're going to continue with what we're doing here. We are speaking with Dr. Fred Previck. We're talking about the dopaminergic brain. We're talking about the role of dopamine in human evolution and human behavior. It's a really beautiful thing. So if you will stick with us, we'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. This is Armand DeMille back with you at The Positive Mind. Our guest, Dr. Fred Previck. The name of the book, The Dopaminergic Mind in Human Evolution and History. Our guest, Dr. Fred Previck, doing his first ever radio interview with us here at WBAI. Fred, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, you know, raspy voice. What were you doing yesterday that made you lose your voice?
Well, I was coaching a soccer match and getting a little too animated, but that's part of you know, my duties as a teacher. So
part of your duties as a teacher is to activate your own dopaminergic mind and make sure it gets activated into doing soccer winnings. I mean, do you think about what you're doing neurochemically when you're playing a soccer game? Do you actually look at the dopamine spilling out of the kids' brains when they're running around the field?
Not so much soccer matches, but when they answer with a really great insight, I said, wow, you know, they're really using their minds, and I think sometimes about dopamine. Of course, when I was writing this book, I was thinking about dopamine all the time, and not only, you know, my own the book's topic, but also in my own situation.
Well, how has your own developed? How has your own dopamine developed, and how have you found that you yourself, because this may be a great lesson for people, have learned to deal with your own dopaminergic mind in such a way that it doesn't have control of you, but that you have some control of it?
Well, yes, I mean, I think as with most scientists, especially those who write textbooks and other types of books and papers, we have to think dopaminergically. We do have probably a lot of dopamine, but I think it's important to nurture the non-dopaminergic parts of our brain. I think it's important to nurture the right hemisphere, and so I've been trying to work a little bit more on that, and I think that's something that all of us could do, you know, restore a little more balance to our lives.
How do we do that? Let's think about it. The other side of the dopaminergic brain would be the serotonergic brain, I guess. Right?
Right. I think it's about trying to relate to others in a more positive or more sophisticated way. I think it's also just about relaxing. I think a lot of people who have a lot of dopamine, you might think they're active and they're really happy, but there's always that obsessiveness about them. There's always that agitation and, you know, not that feeling of being mellow and things like that. I think that we all have to sort of step back, just, you know, relax a little bit, do things that take our mind off, you know, our intellectual matters and things like that. And, I mean, it's hard in our society because, you know, ours is a competitive society. To keep your job, you have to work hard. We're working harder than we ever used to, most professionals. But I do think you have to have balance to your mind.
Well, as a teacher, as somebody who's a teacher and someone who's a scientist and all the work that you've done, you've been so mentally focused that somewhere along the line, something said to you, "And let a little love in your life." Because when we talk about serotonin and we talk about love, we kind of talk about that part of our brain, right? We're talking about affection. We're talking about relationships. We're talking about contact. As opposed to the other side, which is a side that feels like it doesn't need people at all except to use them.
Yes, and I mean, the book really wasn't about serotonin, but it does oppose dopamine in many ways. Serotonin does lift our mood. It makes us a little more contented. It's known to relieve aggressive tendencies a little bit. So, you know, I just think it's maybe associated with a little more passive style, whereas dopamine is classically viewed as part of that active style.
So you're saying that if we nurture the more what's typically known as masculine aggressive dopaminergic style, which I see now in men and women. I see it evolving in women. I see women becoming more dopaminergic and more aggressive in that kind of way, and which may be necessary in our society. But as we see that, Fred Previck is saying, yeah, but listen, get to that serotonergic side of you and nurture it, because if you don't, we're going to be headed off on this kind of wild spree, but not know where we're going. It's like we'd get involved in things and we don't know why we're doing it, you know? And so what you have to do to bring that down to a balance is to find that other part of you. Now, let's go to this for a minute. In the serotonergic brain, you know, I mean, one of the things that we find, people who are depressed lack serotonin. They think Therefore, if we give them a drug that increases their serotonin, we increase their serotonin, or we take away their loss of it, and therefore they become more undepressed. So is that the way? Is it the way everybody has to go on Prozac, you think, Fred?
Well, no, I don't think everybody has to go on medication. You mentioned about a soccer game, and physical activity sets off chemical changes. It also can lift our mood, and there's other ways that can boost our non-dopaminergic transmitters. But the main thing is to sort of quiet our brain, to relax, and not always be in a state of overactivity or constantly worried about the future or constantly striving too much. And it's not just an individual thing. I mean, yes, as individuals we can all try to nurture that hemisphere, but as a society we have to perhaps change a little bit of the over-competitiveness of our society, because an individual who tries to change may find that they're not as competitive in our society today.
Mm. You know, yes, they won't find themselves as competitive, and maybe during certain years of your life, you have to do it to get yourself a solid position, and then at some point you turn around and you give it up. It reminds me of the man who was famous for always, whenever he went to the door of his house, I think a man told me this story, his father, whenever his father came home, he took his hat and his coat and he hung them outside the house. And when he would go, he would then walk into his house, and when asked, why did you hang your hat and your coat outside the house on the porch? He said, because I never want to bring in what's out there into the house. And he disciplined himself to leave everything, his stresses, his strains, outside the house, so that when he could come home, he could be with his family. Now, that kind of consciousness, that kind of thinking, is almost beyond us. People who are highly dopaminergic are told, accused, they point fingers at them and say, relax. Well, that doesn't do anything for you to be told to relax by command. It has to be an invitation. There has to be something that goes with it. And I think the invitation is relationships. I think that what's offered in a romantic relationship and a family kind of invites you into that zone, and that may be its highest value. You know, it invites you to slip around in that serotonergic world a little bit, instead of just being the guy who does everything, but to become part of family, stay connected in some way. I think that's why we need people. That's why people are important to us, to keep us from going off that edge, because it's the people who are alone who I find who get the wackiest around dopamine. You know, the ones who are really unchecked, unless, of course, they're in Blackwater or something, you know, the Army or something. Oh, you used to work for the Air Force, didn't you?
I did, yes.
Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, if I just may add that,
please.
I think relationships are important, nurturing your emotional side. But also, to give you an example, two famous sports figures of the past, maybe I'm dating myself, Don Meredith, who used to be a great quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys and later a football analyst, Tommy Heinsohn was the coach of the Boston Celtics. They both developed an interest in painting. Art is a wonderful way to stimulate your right hemisphere. It's known to be something that involves, because of its manual activity and its visual spatial activity, the right hemisphere. And so after a stressful game in which, you know, there's a lot of dopaminergic activity related to the competitiveness and all, Tommy Heinsohn used to go back and paint. And so that's a nice way to try to balance your activities, a hobby that takes your mind, that uses your hands and things like that. But there's a lot of different ways. The main thing is people have to be aware that they do have too much dopamine, and a lot of people aren't aware that they really do have too much dopamine, especially some of the people who are the leading achievers in our society. They don't realize how they're lacking in other things, because society has given them a lot of rewards for their success, but they don't realize how much they're lacking, not only towards themselves, but maybe towards others.
And it's what they teach their children, too. So what they do, the highly dopaminergic people, train their children to be competitive in school, and you have to play in the soccer team, and you've got to get this, and you got to get into the right school, and you pass it right on, developing even more. If we were to increase the amount of the dopamine that we currently have, Fred, and if it increased over the next 100 years or 200 years, what do you think would happen to the human brain? If nobody did anything to check it, if it didn't check itself, if we just kept on this rat race and kept going, would it be more bank failures? Would it be? I mean, you know, I think the state of the economy is a reflection of the breakdown of the dopaminergic brain. It's a classic, you know? Banks overextending themselves, writing things and doing things that they just, you know, it was all extensions. I'm surprised they didn't come running to you and saying, how could you account for what happened in our economy? And it was all overstretching, all overreaching that created this.
Well, I think that two things could happen, as I describe in my book. I think, one, I am very concerned, as a lot of people are, about the rise in such disorders as autism and attention deficit disorder and even to some extent bipolar disorder and maybe even obsessive compulsive disorder. So there is that concern about our mental health if things keep going as they're going. And then the other thing is, I think, in terms of our society, one thing, the dopaminergic mind is very exploitive. It's always interested in, you know, acquiring things, searching for things, it's goal-oriented and all, but it doesn't necessarily nurture its own right hemisphere, but it doesn't nurture the environment as much as well. And I think now we realize that we may have to calm our lifestyles just to use less energy and do less damage to the environment. So nobody really thought about that until, you know, the last few decades, but I think that's part and parcel of a consequence of the rising dopaminergic mind.
Fred, I'm going to change the subject a bit, but when you and I spoke, we were talking about this concept of thermoregulation. Could you go into that? Because I think that's a very important part of why we developed this dopaminergic personality.
Well, the dopaminergic mind, in my opinion, came about in different stages, but the first big jump in our dopamine levels, and there's no physical evidence for this because we can't recreate the brains of Homo habilis. But about 2 million years ago, we know that the first true Homo came about, and that was Homo habilis. Homo habilis used tools. We know that Homo habilis was specialized for endurance activity, and they apparently went out in the midday sun when other creatures would be resting and would scavenge, maybe even chase hunt some animals until the animals would die of hyperthermia. And so humans developed this incredible ability to move long distances and work in the hot temperatures. And one of the things that made it possible was dopamine. And, dopamine does reduce our heat load. In other words, it reduces our temperature. And when we don't have enough dopamine, we're at risk for hypothermia.
Is that, in other words, that would be like a cold feeling? People would feel when they have a lower dopamine, they'd feel cold?
Yes. For instance, when you have a fever, you actually feel cold. And so when we have fever, our dopamine really kicks in to lower our temperatures. And that's one of the causes we know that fevers in, for instance, pregnancy can lead to disorders such as autism, which is associated with too much dopamine. So, yes, there's a lot of things that can lead to too much dopamine, but one of the things is an elevated temperature can require the greater activation of dopamine in the brain.
So let's just, since we're there, what about Parkinson's and dopamine? There's a common association.
Well, Parkinson's is involved in, it shows up as a disorder of voluntary motor activity, which we know dopamine is involved in, but it also, in the last few decades, we realize is associated with deficits in what we call executive intelligence. So that's another aspect of the decline of dopamine in Parkinson's disease.
And so what they do in Parkinson's is they actually try to increase dopamine?
Yes, the standard therapy, and it has been for several decades, is the precursor to dopamine, known as L-DOPA.
And do people, if people felt that they were serotonergic, dragging, peaceful, but they couldn't get motivated, and we run into, since we run a mental health center, a lot of people come to us and say, I just can't get motivated. I feel so lazy. I feel so unmotivated. Might we suspect a lack of dopamine?
Perhaps. But what people have tried to do, for instance, school children, it's been shown, if they have a lack of future orientation, that's one of the predictors of failure in school. So people have tried to increase their sense of future orientation. Rather than give them dopamine, they try to do it through behavioral means. And because generally we don't give dopamine to people. Now, it is used as one of the treatments for attention deficit disorder, but that's one of the rare instances in which dopamine is actually used as a medication. Usually, most drugs block dopamine because the greater risk is having too much dopamine.
And there are people throughout history that have had significantly increased, or what seem to be significant increases in their dopaminergic minds. Can you tell us about some of the famous people that people might recognize?
Well, in my book, I recount the tales of Alexander the Great, Christopher Columbus, Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein, and Napoleon Bonaparte. But there's so many others. Usually our great leaders have a lot of dopamine, and they're characterized by a lot of vision, a lot of future forward thinking, a lot of goal directedness, even obsessiveness. But they also have, you know, flaws in their personality. In the past, we didn't always pay attention to some of the flaws, but more recently, people are becoming more aware of some of the limitations of some of these individuals.
Well, what we found, is that people who are especially focused, and this goes with ministries and people who are great teachers of ethics and values, they have on one side of their minds, they are very, very avid devotees of a religion or a concept. And then when you look up close, they always get exposed for having some side of their other needs manifest. So you take even somebody like Albert Einstein, right? You said Einstein was a brilliant, brilliant man, highly dopaminergic mind. What was his downside? The lack of the serotonergic mind?
Well, he admitted himself he couldn't get along with individual humans. He liked humanity in general because it was an abstract concept. But, you know, he didn't do well as a husband, and I don't want to judge people, but, you know, he probably wouldn't be characterized as the best father in the world either. He had a lot of friends, but not really necessarily close emotional attachments. And he was well aware of it himself. And so this is one of the limitations he had. He would work on problems and spend day after day in his room, and sometimes not even come out to eat. This is not uncharacteristic of a lot of people when they're really obsessed about something, that they're just thinking way in the distance and not even worried about their own body or their own food or something like that is regulated by a different part of our brain.
Well, Fred, I know that you're going to be on a talk circuit at some point, and I know you're going to be having to give lectures. What you need whenever you're doing a lecture circuit, if you don't mind my telling you, is a good joke. So I'm going to now give you my Albert Einstein joke.
Okay,
here's my Albert Einstein joke. Albert Einstein is putting down a new cement walk outside his house. He's just laying down the cement. And kids come and they start putting their footprints in the cement. And he yells at them. He screams at them. He says, "You kids, get out of here, you rotten kids. I'm just putting down my cement." And his wife comes along and says, Albert, how could you be so harsh on children? You always love children." And he said, "I love children in the abstract, but not in the concrete."
that's very good. Very good.
Agrarian societies, should we go back to it?
Yes.
Braces. Tell me about it.
Well, if I may retrace a little bit, we had a boost in our dopaminergic minds, what I call the proto-dopaminergic minds with Homo habilis. I wouldn't say they're necessarily what we would call characteristic humans, because they didn't show a lot of creativity and advanced intellectual development. But probably with a little effort and, you know, an improved diet, we might actually make them similar to modern humans. But the first really modern behavior seems to occur less than 100,000 years ago, and I think it was improved by the diet. It was associated with an improved diet of shellfish, which has a lot of essential fatty acids, but also things that stimulate dopamine. But then we go even beyond that. Eventually, maybe about 10,000 years ago, humans started developing agriculture. And that leads us to eventually the rise of the ancient civilizations. And think about what happens when you have an agricultural society. For the first time, you're dependent on things that are very distant. For instance, the sun, the rain. You have cycles. You have to predict things. And a lot of rituals, religious rituals, develop that, for instance, relate to praying for rain or something like that. So your concept of distant space really increases. Your sense of time increases when you are moving into the agricultural agrarian society.
And so what are your hopes? What are your hopes for us as a society at this point? I mean, I think your book is very helpful. I think you represent what you speak, you know. You really talk about it from a place of really caring about what happens next. But what do you think are our hopes? Do you think we got a chance? Do you think we have to collapse as a society to pick ourselves back up? Do you think we're just driving ourselves to some kind of end of civilization before we could start all over again? Do you think that's the essence of it? What's your thought? Do you think that the answer is religion?
Well, I think that, there are a lot better people than me that are expert in societal change and environmental consequences and things like that. But I would suggest that the key is sustainability, not only towards the environment, but sustainability of our minds. Friedrich Capra talks about, in his Hidden Connections, he talks about the moving from a linear approach, which is like one direction, moving forward, not worrying about what we've left behind, and constantly on the move and all, to a more circular type of existence where, you know, we recycle our products and, you know, things are moving around and not always in one direction. Because when you're moving in one direction, you're not always aware of the things that have, you've caused, the consequences you've caused in the past. So I think we just need to be a little more nurturing, a little more sustainable. And but it takes not only an individual change, it takes a collective change. And so our leaders have to be paying attention to the fact that maybe our leaders themselves are the ones that need to change, and it has to start at the top as well. And just because they're dopaminergic doesn't mean that's good for society as a whole.
Beautifully said. My guest, Dr. Fred Previck, the book, The Dopaminergic Mind in Human Evolution and History. If you're somebody who likes to understand, it's a wonderful thing. I recommend Fred. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you for your balance in this world that we live in right now. I appreciate it, and I know the listeners will as well.
It's been my pleasure to be with you.
Bye-bye for now. This is Armand DeMille with you at the Positive Mind here at WBAI. Beautiful stuff. Beautiful stuff. Hope it's not too complex. But what you got to do is think about the evolution of humankind. Think about where we came. Think about what brought us here. Think about the beauty of that. And then think about the trap and the question we have right now. Do we become leaders that show a different way of being? Do we, or do we become just more of the same? Do we become people who just perpetuate this until we destroy ourselves? Well, I'm not sure. I think the good news is yet to come. We'll be back with you soon, my friends.
Da 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 da